This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening, and thank you for tuning into Eco Radio. On tonight's program, the climate mobilization folks on the ground in Kansas City come back to our program for the whole hour. But first, I'm Natural E with your headline news. EcoWatch.com reports activists successfully shut down five pipelines on October 11th across the United States that deliver tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada. The pipelines targeted were Enbridge Line 4 and 67 in Leonard, Minnesota, TransCanada's Keystone Pipeline in Walhalla, North Dakota, Spectra Energy's Express Pipeline at Colbanks Landing, Montana, and Kinder Morgan's Trans Mountain Pipeline in Anacortes, Washington. Quote, "We did this in response to Standing Rock's call to action for escalated actions," end quote, a spokesperson for hashtag Shut It Down told EcoWatch. And EcoWatch has since learned that all five activists and four support crew have now been arrested. The largest earthquake ever recorded in Kansas, a 4.9 magnitude trembler that struck northeast of Milan on November 12th of 2014, has been officially linked to wastewater injection into deep underground wells, according to new research from the U.S. Geological Survey. The epicenter of the extremely rare earthquake struck near a known fracking operation. The Wichita Eagle noted from the study that this man-made quake, which hit 40 miles southwest of Wichita and felt as far away as Memphis, likely came from just one or two nearby wells and, quote, "one of those two wells, operated by Sandridge Energy, is still injecting water at the same level as when the earthquake occurred 2 years ago," end quote. Kansas is a region previously devoid of significant seismic activity. However, the number of earthquakes in the state jumped from only four in 2013 to 817 in 2014, the Washington Post reported. Grist.org reports, nearly every country in the world has agreed to cut back on the potent greenhouse gas. The deal among some 170 nations to curb the use of hydrofluorocarbons was struck in Kigali, Rwanda on Saturday. It could avert up to 0.5 degrees Celsius of global warming. That's because hydrofluorocarbons used in refrigerators and air conditioners have roughly 1,000 times more heat-trapping capacity than carbon dioxide. Nations will actually be required to keep these commitments. Whereas the Paris Agreement was not a legally binding treaty, this deal is an amendment to the Montreal Protocol, a 1987 treaty. The Obama administration made this deal a diplomatic priority, and now the president can tout another climate achievement before leaving office. And finally, democracynow.org reports, a North Dakota judge today refused to authorize riot charges against award-winning journalist Amy Goodman for her reporting on an attack against Native American-led anti-pipeline protesters. We will play her statement now.
It is a great honor to be here today. The judge's decision to reject the state's attorney, Ladd Erickson's, attempt to prosecute a journalist, in this case me, is a great vindication of the First Amendment and of our right to report. Oh. On September 3rd, the Democracy Now! Team came to North Dakota to the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation, to the resistance camps, to cover this epic struggle. Native people on the front lines, particularly Native American women, on the front lines, who are taking on not only the Dakota Access Pipeline, but a global issue of climate justice, taking on the global issue of global warming. Yeah. Democracy Now! Has been covering climate justice issues for the full 20 years that we have been broadcasting. We go to every UN climate summit. So often it's indigenous people on the front lines. We covered the Keystone XL pipeline. Now we're covering the Dakota Access Pipeline. And the important role of a journalist is to go to where the silence is. We should not be alone in the major media coming to cover this historic unification of Native Americans from more than 200 tribes from Latin America to the United States to Canada. All of the media should be there, given the scope of this struggle. And we encourage all of the media to come here. We certainly will continue to cover this struggle. It's not only to protect the water and land rights, but it's covering your right to speak, to be heard. We are not the only ones who have been charged. We faced misdemeanor. I faced misdemeanors. But I know there are a number of people who are going to court even as we speak here. Also important to point out other journalists who are being arrested. The state's attorney was attempting to stop journalism. The state's attorney must respect freedom of the press and the First Amendment. On September 3rd, we came to North Dakota and covered the Native Americans going down the road from the camp to plant their tribal flags at their burial ground. They were surprised to learn at their sacred ground, and I'm sure a number of you were there, that the Dakota Access Pipeline was actually actively excavating at that moment on this holiday weekend. They urged the bulldozers to stop. The security guards came out with their dogs and pepper spray. The dogs bit the protesters. Democracy Now! Videotaped the bloody dog with blood dripping from his mouth and his nose, biting not only protesters or protectors, the land and water protectors, but the Native Americans' horses as well. These images went viral. 14 million people almost immediately saw these images around the world. All of the networks then published, then played excerpts of that video. CBS Evening News, NBC, MSNBC, CNN, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, BBC, NPR, and it went on from there. We call that trickle-up journalism. The state cannot stop this journalism. The state must not stop this journalism. Violating the First Amendment is not good for North Dakota. It's not good for this country. I want to we together, and I want to point out my colleagues, the Democracy Now! Team, John Hamilton, who continues to film today as he has been filming with us. Laura Gottesdiener, Laura, where are you? Laura, wave your hand. Who is tireless in her reporting on these issues. And Dennis Moynihan behind me, who is this team was so critical in bringing out the story. I also want to thank Hani Massoud, and again, our lawyers Reed Brody and Tom Dixon. Most importantly, I want to thank everybody for being here, for showing up, for standing up for freedom of the press. And standing up for freedom of the press goes beyond journalism. Freedom of the press is about the public's right to know. That right to know is sacred. That's what makes a democracy meaningful, when you are able to make informed decisions. We've got to open up the media to everyone's voice. I see the media as a huge kitchen table that stretches across the globe that we all sit around and debate and discuss the critical issues of the day. When you hear someone speak for themselves, a Lakota grandmother, an Ojibwe grandchild, it breaks down barriers. It challenges the caricatures and stereotypes that fuel the hate groups. It is so important that we open up this dialogue. You don't have to agree with what you hear, but you begin to understand where people are coming from. That's the beginning of peace. I think the media can be the greatest force for peace on earth. Unfortunately, all too often it's wielded as a weapon of war, which is why we have to take the media back. Thank you for coming out here today. We will continue to cover what happens at the resistance camps, what happens in the reservation, what happens at the excavation sites, what happens behind the bars in the Mandan jail. One of the issues we've been covering now extensively just today is the number of people charged with low-level misdemeanors like, Dr. Sarah Jumping Eagle, the pediatrician on the reservation, on the Standing Rock Reservation, charged with disorderly conduct, brought to this jail and strip searched.
Wow.
The chair of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, the chair, Standing Rock Sioux's Dave Archambault, charged in a civil disobedience, brought to this jail and strip searched. It is very important that we cover all of these issues. More than 140 people have been arrested so far. Democracy Now! Will continue to be there, this daily grassroots global news hour. We send a shout out to the media at the camp, to Native media all over. It's so important that your voices are broadcast, that you capture what's happening on the ground as well. And we demand that the corporate media also come here and broadcast the voices of those who are on the front lines of democracy. Democracy Now! Is about movements. It's movements that make history. Thank you for being here, for talking to us. Democracy Now!
Okay, that was Amy Goodman, and this is Richard Mabian. I sound good to be in the same mouth, the same phrase with her, isn't it? Glad you're here. It seems like whenever we have this group we have here right now on, there's always something that comes up that we have to take some time out to listen to or whatever. But we had them on here a couple of weeks ago, and it was such a good time that we felt like that we wanted to bring them back. Now, I tell you, I'm going to have each one of them, I'm going to go around and have each one of them introduce themselves just briefly, and then I'm going to start this off.
Hello, I am Craig Wolf, and I'm the Communications Director for the Kansas Chapter of the Sierra Club, and I'm also the President of the Heartland Renewable Energy Society.
My name is Josh King. I'm the Chairperson of the Kansas City Climate Coalition, a member of 350KC, and also a core volunteer of the climate mobilization.
And I'm John Kerman. I am with 350KC as well, and we are all volunteers with the climate mobilization.
Okay, so you see I'm sitting here with some very powerful folks. Now what I'm going to do is give out the number, and then we're going to have, while you're writing this down and running and getting your pens and thinking of some comments, you may want to call in and join us. The number is 816-931-5534, 816-931-5534. Now, we're going to start off. We have one of our other hosts that I guess he emailed us in, Mike, and Mike's going to read off his questions. He had a couple of questions. We're going to start the program with that, fellas.
Yeah, he actually posted this on our Facebook page. So his first question, and this is Craig Lubo, who has some business items come up tonight that he couldn't make it down for. So his first question. I have not heard anything about population from most of the environmental organizations, including the Climate Mobilization, 350.org, et cetera, the Sierra Club. Oh, hold on one sec. Do you want to be on the air? Sorry about that. Sierra Club is one of the few that at least have a national committee dedicated to the issue. When we already have more than 7 billion population with a projection of 9 billion or more before the end of the century, would you agree that if we fail to tackle the population problem, it will be impossible to tackle global warming in terms of both carbon and methane? If so, what attention will your organization bring to the population issue? Do you want the second question or now, or do you want to
go? Let's do one at a time.
Okay.
You think so? I was thinking you get both of them that way.
I'd rather do one at a time.
Okay. There's a lot to digest there.
Yeah. So He's absolutely right. 350.org does not, in my experience, say anything about population growth and how we need to address that in order to deal with the climate crisis, but I think that's absolutely true. Funnily enough, one of the first issues I worked on when I became an activist back in 1994 was population growth and consumption, the flip side of population growth, because it's not just a question of how many of us there are, but how much each of us is consuming. I worked with zero population growth. The way I always put it into perspective is I'm 51 years old. I was born in 1965, so I've looked at the U.S. Census Bureau's estimate of what the population was of the world the year I was born. It was 3.3 billion. It's now over 7.1 billion, which means just within my lifetime, the world's population has more than doubled. That's a little staggering to me to conceive of that. And we're still growing. Last time I looked, we were growing by about 77 million people a year is the estimate. So it's very rapid growth, growing 77 million people a year, yet a billion people about every 13 or 14 years. We can't keep that up. We won't solve the climate crisis if we keep that up. It does have to be dealt with, absolutely, I think. Josh, you probably know more about the details of the Climate Mobilization Victory Plan. Is population mentioned at all in there?
I don't believe it's mentioned specifically. I think it's in its first draft. The Victory Plan is the first policy proposal by the Climate Mobilization to talk about concrete steps to take to address climate change. But I think that population is part of a larger shift in our global orientation to balance with the environment. And so it's not just a question to me. Population growth is a part of recognizing that there are limits to growth, there are limits to natural resources, and so it's a single piece of a much larger conversation, in my view.
You know, it just is logical to me that if we continue adding more and more people, there will be I can't remember what the throttle or a negative throttle on population growth, but that will be associated with starvation and disease and a bunch of other things.
It's called die-off.
Yeah, called die-off, you know. And the climate crisis is going to be one of those things that is the throttle down for our ability to live on the planet. So, you know, we have to learn how to fly this little ship, and we're not doing a very good job right now.
Yeah, you know, and we have to look at both the population growth and the consumption growth. And consumption here in the United States. Years ago, I read a paper by Paul Ehrlich, who's like the father of the concern about population growth, wrote the population bomb back in the 1960s. And the title of the paper was The Most Overpopulated Nation on Earth. And he was talking about the United States. And the reason for that is that the U.S. has the third largest population of all nations in the world, and we have close to the highest consumption rate in the world. So once you combine those two, we count as the most overpopulated nation in the world. So we have to deal with both, and the U.S. population is still growing, absolutely still is.
When you was talking, bringing it up, it made me think about the conversation Josh and I had a few minutes ago about climate change and versus the inner city. And you can think in terms of it being one of many issues that people in the inner city think about. So while population is a factor, when you're dealing with it from the perspective where we are now, you just kind of get in a chopping order. Like I think you were saying that, what's first, second, third? I mean, you don't want to do that, but you have there's just no way you can go about it without
sure.
doing it. So it becomes, it's not that people aren't thinking about it or wanting to deal with it. It's just a lot of the major issues in
sure
your face.
Is.
Okay, Mike?
Yeah, okay, so...
Mike, just one comment about how to throttle down population growth. The one factor that people who are concerned about the issue have observed is that when young women who tend not to be educated in poorer and third world countries, when young women become educated, that in itself is the throttle on population.
Okay.
Because they have more power then.
Good point.
And you have to make family planning actually available to people too.
Yes.
And I think also to go back to that conversation we were having before we came on the air, we were talking about that prioritization of the most important issues. And to me, climate change is the one that trumps everything else, because you can't talk about getting a good job if your entire economy is destroyed because of global warming. You can't talk about having good food or solving food deserts if 90% of your crops are destroyed. So I think it's, again, coming back to that most important issue and looking at it from that perspective.
Okay. Actually, we're going to go to our first break before we ask Craig's second question. So I bet the suspense is killing you guys.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah.
On the next Sprouts, co-founder and president of Bioneers, Nina Simons, an award-winning social entrepreneur and visionary thinker, talks about far-reaching questions about organizing for systematic change amid convergent ecological crises. Thursday at noon.
Do you have an old car, boat, or motorcycle that you are looking to get rid of? Why not donate it to KKFI and get a tax deduction as well? Call Bill at 816-994-7869 for more information.
For pet's sake, avoid the algae on this current cast. Too many nutrients in lakes and ponds can cause algae to grow out of control, producing harmful algal blooms. Some unleash toxins that threaten our health and our animals too. When ingested, touched, or even inhaled, they can make your pet sick or even die. So what can you do?
Well, the first step is prevention.
That's Karen Bischoff of Cornell University. She says you cannot tell by looking if a bloom makes toxins or not, so keep animals away. If you catch Fido in green, scummy water, remove him quickly and don't let him lick his paws or fur.
The best bet is to get him cleaned up as fast as possible and consult with a veterinarian.
When it comes to your precious pet, it's better to be safe than sorry. Current Cast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future, supported by New York's Environmental Protection Fund and Sea Grant, online at currentcast.org.
All right, I'm still teasing you with Craig's second question, but we're going to delay that a little more because we have a caller on the air.
Okay, caller, you on the air. Will you give me your first name and the part of the city you're calling from, please?
Hi, this is Sharon. Okay. And I'm actually calling from the state of Washington.
Oh, you didn't let him know that was you calling. How you doing,
no,
Sharon?
I
told him you might be giving us a call in, and I'm glad you did, because no one here is aware of that weather problem y'all had up there. When was that, last weekend or something like that?
Oh, it was like over the last, I guess it was about 4 days. It kind of finished up Sunday morning.
Okay, now that I've told them who you are, that you just got back from doing a sold-out show up in New York with the Climate Monologues, and I wanted them to hear about that particular situation, because that's what we're here talking about right now, the things that's happening to us in our atmosphere. So can you share that with us, please?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, you want me to talk about the situation that's right up here?
In
what just happened in Washington State?
Right.
Yeah. Well, there was a severe storm warning, and we didn't get as badly hit here as they have in other places along the South Puget Sound. But the predictions were for severe wind and rain, significant rainfall and winds, in some places gusting over 50 miles an hour, in some places gusting as much as over 80 miles an hour. And I actually meant to go and look and see how much damage was sustained down south of where we are, because we tend to be in a little bit of a banana belt surrounded by water. So we didn't really get hit so badly. We just had, some limbs come down and things like that. But I know other places had trees come down over power lines and power was out in significant metropolitan areas. And, that's the problem with climate change, is that there are more frequent storms, more severe storms, and more instances of these things happening.
One of the things I heard them say you had, what do you call those, water funnels? What do you call those?
Water
sprouts.
Oh,
water sprouts.
A cyclone or a tsunami?
Yes, they had something like that occurred in there somewhere, because they were showing pictures, and that was down at the southern Puget Sound. But I know that was something that was kind of unusual for them to see that happen, and it happened up there. So
yeah, it's pretty alarming when you hear about things like that out here. We don't generally have those kind of things.
Okay. Well, I'm going to let you go. I just wanted you to call in, say hello, and give you a shout-out. Tell Mike I said hello. And
will
just,
do, and I'm appreciating the discussion on zero population growth, because that is like the one remaining taboo issue. It used to be climate change and zero population growth, and now it's pretty much just population growth, but it is an important subject.
Are your climate monologues online anyplace?
Actually, yeah, you can go to climatemonologues.com and learn a bunch about the show, and there's about 15 minutes of video excerpts up there.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Sharon.
So
take care now.
Take care.
Okay. Now we'll go with Craig's second question.
Yeah. So, Craig's second question. We hear about global warming mostly from the perspective of excessive carbon via fossil fuels and methane in ag. That addresses our contribution to the increase in carbon at the front end, but fails to address the issue of carbon at the back end. We hear very little about the impact on global warming as a result of deforestation. The forests are the mechanism for natural removal of carbon, and we are destroying the forests. If we eliminate all fossil fuel production everywhere, we still do not eliminate global warming if we fail to stop deforestation. So why aren't the environmental groups talking about that issue more?
Well, one thing I will say, I referenced the Victory Plan, and in the policy proposals as part of the Victory Plan from the climate mobilization is an argument for reforestation and reclaiming some of the land that we have used for industrial purposes, some of the land that we have destroyed over a number of years, and reforesting that area as a carbon sink. So rather than just stopping deforestation, actually running the other direction and basically enlivening our forests. So I think that's a key component. And there was one other piece.
I don't know what you were going to say.
I'll come back to it.
I'm not telepathic yet, Josh, but I have something. I have something to say about it. I don't think it's quite fair to say that the organizations are not talking about deforestation. We do talk about it, but it isn't as stressed as much as the emissions from fossil fuels. And the fundamental reason for that, at least in the case of 350, is that it's the fossil fuel industries which are the primary entities blocking action on climate. And the way they do that is they have funded for decades disinformation campaigns to keep the public confused about how settled the science is on global warming and climate change. And they also influence our elections. They pump money into our elections to ensure that people get elected, a lot of them, who are either outright deniers or just aren't willing, don't see the climate change issue as enough of a crisis to take real serious action about it. So unless we break the power, literally have enough political power to break the power of the fossil fuel industries over our governments, we will not get the action we need. So that's why the focus, part of the reason why the focus is mostly on fossil fuels.
I remembered what I was going to say.
I figured you did.
Yeah, I remembered. The feedback loops, that's another key piece. So not only if you lose those forests, you're going to increase climate change, increase temperature, increase desertification, but you have to also look at the albedo feedback loop, where you have less reflective surfaces on the Earth, which are reducing the amount of snow that bounce electromagnetic waves back into space, right? And so that increases the amount of heat that's trapped by the oceans. It increases the melt-off of the ice. That decreases further the reflective surface. So you have this feedback loop in terms of the albedo reflection and also in terms of permafrost destruction. So I think that component of deforestation, of the albedo feedback loop, all of those things are things we have to walk back intentionally.
I think you meant infrared waves, though, not the electromagnetic.
Well, they're a brand of electromagnetics. So.
All right, so you got something?
Well, I was just going to say, if everyone's fully answered Craig's question before you go on to something else, why don't we knock out that second break?
Okay.
This will be
yeah, we're right on it.
Yeah.
On the next Making Contact, Women Rising Radio takes us inside the movement for nuclear disarmament to meet the women on the front lines of the fight for a future free of nuclear weapons. From the U.S. to Russia, the U.K., Israel, the Marshall Islands, and Japan, these dedicated advocates make the case for returning to the Non-Proliferation Treaty and fulfilling its mandate. Hear their stories Thursday afternoon at 12:30.
On August 16, 2012, 34 platinum mine workers were gunned down by the police under the auspices of South Africa's African National Congress. The ensuing outrage became a turning point in South African history. This week on the Heartland Labor Forum, we'll interview the authors of a new book about the Marikana Massacre. Then we'll talk with the authors of another new book called Hesitant Comrades, The Irish Revolution and the British Labor Movement. Thursday at 6 p.m., rebroadcast Friday, 5 a.m.
Okay, I'm back. We were sitting and setting our agenda for the rest of the show because I want this show to be these three fellas' show. That was one of our reasons for wanting to come back in. I'm going to be just like you sitting at home. If I got a question, instead of me having to call in, I'll raise my hand because I'm here in front of them. You can call in, 816-931-5534, 816-931-5534. Now, they represent two organizations. One is Climate Coalition, and the other one is Climate Mobilization, for those of you who weren't able to hear them a couple of weeks ago. So, fellas, I want y'all to take this and bring it to us in the manner that you want us to hear.
We actually, I would say that this is a pretty much a direct shoot out of 350.org. We were getting together with 350.org to do things, and we said, well, there's going to be a climate march, and hey, we're going to do this climate march on November 29th of last year. And so we said, you know, we should really form a coalition that we're going to call the KC Climate Coalition that really is focused only on this one issue, the climate crisis or the climate emergency. Used to call it global warming, then they call it climate change. I'm kind of settling in on the climate emergency because that's what it really is. And then the three of us almost simultaneously got involved in an organization called the Climate Mobilization. And at its core, it's saying that if this is really, if the climate crisis is really an emergency, does what's going on around us on the planet look like a real emergency? And they use the metaphor of what happened in World War II after the Pearl Harbor bombings, because we as a nation almost instinctively stopped building cars and began building airplanes and tanks. And so, again, the question, if this is a real emergency, and we know exactly what has to be done, if this is a real emergency, why aren't we putting on the brakes with other types of industry and going to wind energy and solar energy? And this has to happen right now, folks. This is an emergency, and we need to start behaving as if it really were.
Yeah, I think it's important to make one distinction. Though all three of us are involved with the KC Climate Coalition and all three of us are involved with the climate mobilization, the KC Climate Coalition has not embraced the climate mobilization concept. And the basic reason for that is that it's a coalition of people from different organizations, and not all of those people, though they all agree that climate is an emergency, are persuaded that the climate mobilization concept is viable. They're concerned, frankly, that it's too radical and its implications, because we literally are talking about massive government intervention in the economy to direct a mobilization to deal with the climate crisis. My response to that is, if it genuinely is an emergency, nothing short of radical action will suffice to avert a climate catastrophe, which is why I'm on board with mobilization. But I just wanted to make that distinction so we don't have any of our fellow members of the KC Climate Coalition chewing us out for blurring the lines there. So we're involved in both, and if folks want to get involved in the KC Climate Coalition, you can go to kcclimate.org or go to our Facebook page, KC Climate Coalition.
So within the organizations itself, you're having some differences of opinion. Is that what I'm hearing?
I think I would describe it more that the three of us have a unison of opinion, and that's why we are pushing the climate mobilization. Not everyone is going to agree with us. We happen to be kind of our self-taught experts on the topic, and from what the three of us have gleaned, we say this is the right message and the right organization to be pushing this.
Well, the reason I asked that is because within our structure now, within the operation of almost everything we see happening in this country, we're starting to get divisions within organizations. You had Bernie Sanders and Hillary. You got these different divisions. You got Trump and then all the rest of the Republicans. So I'm just using those two because they're on the front burner. But it seems like I think we're starting to see that happen even in other organizations coming along the way. That's why I was wondering if that's an issue. But go ahead, Josh.
Well, you know, you mentioned Bernie Sanders, and Bernie Sanders has actually referenced climate mobilization. Now, not specifically the organization that we're talking about, but mobilizing like we did during World War II. He referenced that in one of his speeches, I think, last April, mm-hmm. right? And then I believe it was in July that the Democratic National Convention adopted climate mobilization as part of their platform moving forward. So this is, I think, an idea that appears radical to most people because we are used to a certain way of living that's really only about 50 years old. And we need to expand our view of history and expand our view into the future to realize that what we're doing in terms of resource extraction, in terms of fossil fuel combustion, is not going to work long term. So I think that when you're talking about business as usual, the climate mobilization is a platform and an idea which challenges activism as usual.
Okay, explain the radicalism. What are they seeing as being radical?
Well, I mean, we're talking about, so we have this notion ambient in American culture that not that everyone embraces it, but a very strong strain of it, that government should not govern all that much, that government should be small and it should only do a little things, and we should deregulate as much as possible, and we should privatize as much as possible. Well, the climate mobilization, frankly, is just the opposite of that. The climate mobilization says this is an emergency. We cannot wait for the market to handle it because the market doesn't have the incentives necessary to move with the speed we need to move to avert a climate crisis. So the government must direct things. And people rightly say that's unrealistic. But the fundamental point we all agree on is that continued gradualism, which is this slow moving of progress, little pieces at a time, the clean power plan, the new fuel economy standards for cars, the hydrofluorocarbon agreement, this gradual approach is going to get billions of people killed and cause a mass extinction. Unrealistic or not, we need to push for a solution that will be in scale to the crisis.
Right.
Anything smaller than that, literally, gets people killed, and lots of people killed, plus other life.
From what perspective, just so folks are wondering, what do you mean it gets people killed? How?
Because the thing people don't understand about the climate crisis is that it's not like the other pollution crises that we've had in the past in the United States. I'm talking primarily about Americans because that's what I know. I think there's a lot of similarity with other countries, but Americans are acting as if we can wait to deal with the climate crisis. We can wait and see if things get really hot, and we can wait and see if the weather gets really nasty and destructive. And if it does, then we'll take it seriously and we'll act. And that's the way we've dealt with air pollution in this country. That's the way we dealt with water pollution in this country. We had to have rivers catching fire. We almost let our national symbol, the bald eagle, go extinct, almost drove the bald eagle to extinction before we acted and passed the Endangered Species Act. We can't do that with climate because the way the physics of the atmosphere work and global warming, greenhouse gases, by the time it is so obvious that we have a problem that no one can really deny it anymore, too much warming will already be in the pipeline because there's a lag between when we emit greenhouse gases and when their full warming effect is experienced. Scientists don't know exactly how that long that is, but it's measured in terms of decades. So what that means is if today we stopped all greenhouse gas emissions, the climate would continue to warm decades into the future. Scientists say that even if we stopped all emissions today, something on the order of 0.6 degrees Celsius of warming would still occur. And of course, we're not going to stop all emissions today. So that's one reason. Second reason is once you've put, smog is another form of air pollution. If you stop doing the things that cause smog, it dissipates very quickly. Matter of weeks, gone. You've seen this when China hosted the Olympics in 2008. They shut down driving. They shut down the power plants that were burning things to clear the air in time for the Olympics, and it worked. Carbon pollution is not like that. Carbon pollution stays in the atmosphere for hundreds to thousands of years in the future. It's only gradually taken back out of the atmosphere. So that's point two why we can't wait for the climate crisis, because we have no way to take large volumes of that back out of the atmosphere once it's in there. And then there's the climate tipping points. So as Josh alluded to earlier, talked about earlier, the warming we directly cause by our emissions produces changes that result in additional warming. The example Josh talked about earlier is the melting of ice and snow, which changes the reflectivity of the surface, because ice and snow are more reflective than the underlying surface, the underlying land or sea. So that darker surface absorbs heat, producing additional warming. Melting of the permafrost. When the permafrost melts, it's no longer permafrost. And that results in decomposition of the underlying organic matter, which releases both carbon dioxide and methane, which is a much more potent heat-trapping gas than carbon dioxide is. So we cause the warming that causes the melting, which produces these additional changes that cause more warming. And suddenly you're looking, instead of 4 or 5 degrees Celsius of warming, 7, 8 degrees Celsius of warming. Mm-hmm. There's these feedback loops, reinforcing feedback loops that once triggered, we cannot reverse. These are irreversible changes. Okay. So that's why we have to act now, even though it doesn't seem like it's an emergency to most people. If you're living on a small Pacific island and you're watching the seas rise, it sure as hell feels like an emergency there. But we Americans are not feeling it that way yet. And somehow we have to wake Americans up. Not sure how to do that. I'm not sure we even can do that. But that's the only thing that is up to the scale of the crisis, is mobilization, in my opinion. So we have to do the damnedest best we can.
Okay.
Well, and, you know, you asked how are people going to die, right? What's really going to happen here? We can talk about the science, but what's the impact? So when you have rising seas, obviously, that will force individuals, that will force populations inward. And you see that happening in Bangladesh right now. So there are massive weather events that are taking place. But one of the most striking pieces for me is the EPA projects something like 100 days in Missouri and Kansas. 100 days out of the year will be over 90 degrees Fahrenheit. So when you start talking about that, then you have to start talking about crop failures. And mm-hmm. crop failures, that's when you're looking at how can a crop survive if we're cooking it to death while it's on the field. Now, if you take that component alone, that's scary enough. But when you also incorporate flooding, massive floods combined with very unpredictable droughts, then you're looking at a complete upheaval of our food source. Those are just two pieces, not in addition to the major weather events that you're talking about that your caller just referenced in the Northwest. So there is something that I think a variety of people, including Bill Nye, reference as the new normal. And it's up to us to decide what that new normal is going to be. But it is going to be real, and I think that's the thing that people don't realize, is just how much of a crisis, an emergency this really is. And because of that lag, we're not going to get that Pearl Harbor aha moment until it's too late. Yeah. So now is the time to act.
And just we've heard the doom and gloom from these guys, and I agree 100% with everything they've said. But on the other side of the coin, well, there's a symbol, a Chinese symbol that is purported, although there's some disagreement with it, but it's purported that there's a Chinese symbol for crisis. And that symbol is danger. It's actually two symbols. One is danger and one is opportunity. Well, let's talk a little bit about the opportunity. And I'm also a presenter for the Climate Reality Project, which is Al Gore's organization that he creates leaders out there who go out and make presentations. One of the slides in that presentation has a remarkable mini statistic that is overwhelming. That is, in 1 hour, enough energy is received by the Earth to power the planet for a year. So it's not like, gee, how are we going to do this? We know exactly how we're going to do it, but we need the political will to get it done.
Okay, we're going to take this final break. That number for calling in is 816-931-5534, 816-931-5534. We'll be right back.
This week on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
You could say that our justice system harms people who harm people to show that harming people is wrong. Restorative justice is a justice that heals.
It's restorative justice, from harm to healing, this week on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Friday morning at 9:30, right before Eclectics.
October 18 is the deadline for U.S. citizens in Kansas to register to vote November 8. The Missouri deadline has already passed. If you've moved, you must re-register at your new address. Registered voters in Kansas should check their status on the website of their county election office, because Kansas reportedly has programs to remove names from the voter rolls. This message is a public service of 90.1 FM, Kansas City Community Radio.
Okay, we're back, and you know why we were away. I was telling the fellas that what they just said here and did is exactly what this show is supposed to be about. I had so many emotions. I was just sitting there listening and realizing, one, that's what KKFI is about. What you're hearing from them is you won't hear anyplace else. You won't hear anyplace else over the air like this at the mass amount of people that can listen to this show and hear what's being said. And I think they painted a beautiful picture right there of exactly what we're dealing with. You know, we're dealing with a circumstance that people better wake up and start realizing and hearing what they're saying. I think you did a great job, all three of you. I mean, we got a few minutes here left. I want you to kind of hit on the points you want to touch on.
Well, last time we were here, you asked me if, you know, an individual was listening to this radio broadcast right now, what can that individual go do? So I went home and I made a list. All right, okay. So here's my list.
I like homework.
There you go, homework. First of all, educate yourself. There are two resources I think are very helpful. One is the climatemobilization.org. You look at the Victory Plan. It's a 110-page document, first draft, of what we can actually do. You asked what was radical about it. Zero, net zero emissions by 2030. That kind of turnaround is, we're not talking about what's realistic anymore. We're talking about what's possible for something we've never faced.
And what's necessary.
And what's necessary. Resource two, the IPCC assessment reports, which I talked about briefly last time. The summary reports are not too scientific for individuals to be able to read, so check those out. Second of all, get involved in politics. And I don't care if you're on the left or the right, because this is going to affect everybody. Press your candidates. Make this the number one issue, because it is the number one issue. And we at kcclimate.org have a candidate guide to climate change, which people can use. It's a two-page document that will basically educate them, and they can use to talk to their candidates. Vote, obviously. That's very important, because without leadership, what we're saying here doesn't matter. Have the courage to face the climate crisis for what it is and engage other people. And finally, get involved locally. And I think that's what we're really here to talk about, kcclimate.org, KC Climate Coalition, and the climate mobilization. That's all I have.
And be prepared to get off your duff. because we will not build a movement strong enough to drive the climate mobilization sitting in front of our televisions or our internet.
Or Facebook.
We got to get out in the streets. I don't know of any movement for major change in society that succeeded without getting masses of people up and out of their seats into the streets demanding action. We have to drive the action. Our politicians have too many pressures on them from those who don't want action taken to do this on their own. We have to push them. Whoever gets elected in whichever office, we got to push and push hard.
Okay.
And that, I think, is the biggest challenge right there. It is so frustrating for us to have meetings and movements and try to elect candidates, and the general public does not show up yet. They have to start showing up. They have to believe this is up to them. It's not up to the three of us to fix this thing. It's up to everybody to fix this thing.
Okay, well, I'm going to tell you, I think you did a beautiful job, and in the work that you all know that I'm doing in the areas that are far below par as far as folks' understanding about what we're talking about, it's kind of like the work that I'm doing is beneficial in the sense that when you all are coming this way now, is how they can meet, because people want to know, what, just like I asked you, well, what can we do? Mm-hmm. Well, there needs to be some place that people can reach out to. And with you all getting this public image that you're starting to create, we got that out here now. Thank you, folks, and I'll see you when I'm back on my next show, Naturally.
Yes, thank you, Richard. On October 20th from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., MARC is hosting a climate resilience workshop. Learn how cities are working to reduce the negative air quality issues caused by urban heat islands at a climate resilience workshop sponsored by the Mid-America Regional Council. Dark, dry surfaces such as roofs, parking lots, and roads, coupled with a lack of vegetation, help warm a city on a summer afternoon. Urban heat islands are urban air temperatures that exceed rural air temperatures have been observed in many cities. The urban heat island effect can increase demand for air conditioning, impair air quality, and aggravate heat-related illnesses on a hot summer day. So you can come and hear from Dr. Ronan Levinson, a staff scientist and leader of the Heat Island Group at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in Berkeley, California, at this workshop from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. on October 20th at the MARC Conference Center, which is at 600 Broadway, and visit marc.org for more information. On October 22nd, from 9 in the morning till noon, the Environmental Action Committee of Village Church is partnering with the Sustainable Sanctuary Coalition to host a recycling reuse event from 9 a.m. to noon in the south parking lot of Village Church. There is a suggested, and so you can take your old computers, components, printers, copiers, cell phones at this event, and you can call Jerry at 913-568-4250 for more information. This is at the Village Church at 66 and Mission Road.
Thank you very much, Naturally. Just a couple things to let you know about coming up on KKFI. Tomorrow on Counterspin, there's a look at how the Dakota Access Pipeline is being portrayed in the media in Counterspin. And next week on Eco Radio KC, we're going to be talking to some people who are fighting against the Dakota Access Pipeline in Iowa. And that's next week's Eco Radio KC, and that's Monday at 6 p.m. So do stay tuned. This podcast will be up shortly. We're going to go out, as we quite often do, with This Week in Water.
A cool way to stop warming the planet. That and other stories on H2O Radio's weekly news report about water. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
President Obama praised it, and Secretary of State John Kerry said it was monumental.
On Saturday, 170 nations reached a legally binding agreement to cut the use of a powerful global warming chemical that's commonly used in refrigerators and air conditioners.
Hydrofluorocarbons are a small part of greenhouse gas emissions, but are 1,000 times more powerful than carbon dioxide in trapping heat in the Earth's atmosphere.
The agreement to eliminate HFCs was 7 years in the making and is expected to remove the equivalent of 70 billion tons of CO2. That's about twice the carbon pollution produced by the entire world in a year, according to the New York Times.
Officials from industry were at the meeting leading to the agreement and supported it, saying that they have already been working on developing replacement chemicals.
John Kerry told the BBC that the agreement will give us the opportunity to reduce the warming of the planet a half degree centigrade by the end of the century.
Hurricane Matthew devastated parts of Haiti on October 4th, killing an estimated 550 people. And now the country is just starting to come to grips with the damage done to its food production sector.
In various regions of Haiti, almost 100% of the crops and about half of the livestock were completely lost, according to the World Food Program. And the fishing industry has been paralyzed as equipment was washed away.
Some crops, such as rice and vegetables, may be replaceable faster than others, but fruit trees that had existed for generations will likely take a decade to recover.
After Matthew moved to the U.S., the hurricane had devastating effects on food production in North Carolina. Reuters reports that up to 5 million chickens and turkeys were killed on poultry farms in the southeast part of the state.
The governor of North Carolina said that nearly 5,000 hogs had been killed by the flooding, and one of the immediate problems was to bury them as soon as possible. But Rick Dove of Waterkeeper Alliance estimated that tens of thousands of hogs may still be in floodwaters.
There were also concerns about flooding of chicken and hog manure pits that store waste on farms. Flooded waste lagoons could contaminate rivers and water supplies for surrounding areas. Aerial photographs showed that some of the manure pools were completely underwater.
While activists were maintaining their protests at the Dakota Access Pipeline last week, other protesters took direct action against tar sands pipelines in four different states.
Early in the morning last Tuesday, activists cut padlocks and turned off valves at remote tar sands flow stations in Washington, Montana, North Dakota, and Minnesota.
Those pipelines carry crude produced from Canada's oil sands to the United States and have been fought for years by environmentalists.
Many of the activists who participated on Tuesday have been arrested. In addition, award-winning filmmaker Daya Schlossberg was charged with three counts of conspiracy for filming the North Dakota pipeline protest.
Various celebrities, including singer Neil Young and actor Mark Ruffalo, have called for the charges to be dropped against Schlossberg, saying that she was acting as a journalist.
Another documentary filmmaker, Lindsay Grazel, told Reuters that she was arrested in Washington State while filming the activists on Tuesday and said her footage was confiscated. She had not been charged as of Thursday afternoon.
Jay O'Hara, a spokesman for Direct Climate Action, said that the aim of the protest was to avert a climate change catastrophe which the planet is barreling toward without adequate public policy.
The energy used to pump, treat, and deliver water is significant, and it also contributes to global warming. Scientists have concluded that conserving water can lower greenhouse gas emissions from electricity generation.
A bill recently signed by California Governor Jerry Brown is focusing on the amount of electrical energy that is used by our water systems, from everything to delivering water to consumers, treating wastewater, and then disposing of it.
California water utilities will now voluntarily track the greenhouse emissions generated from their power use.
Frank Loge of the University of California at Davis, along with other researchers, has found that there is a significant amount of electricity saved through reducing urban water use.
In fact, during conservation efforts in 2015, the savings were roughly equivalent to the electricity conserved by the state's four major energy utilities that year.
Loge notes that making a connection between energy and water savings will also help persuade policymakers to fund more water conservation efforts.
In California, water utilities and wastewater treatment facilities use nearly 20% of the state's electricity supply, a number that could grow as the ongoing drought further stresses water supplies. And finally this week, Italy is famous for its fountains. Think the Trevi in Rome or Tivoli Gardens outside the city.
The Mediterranean nation is also famous for its wine.
And now it may be a huge travel destination for combining the two.
A fountain open to the public and flowing with red wine has appeared in the Abruzzo region just east of Rome, and it's free for the taking 24/7.
The Doris Arcesi Vineyard wanted to offer refreshment to the thousands of pilgrims who travel hundreds of miles to visit the local cathedral, which keeps the remains of St. Thomas the Apostle.
But before you book your flight to party in Italy, the winery has a stern warning on its Facebook page that the fixture isn't for drunkards or louts.
And because it's gratis, no whining about having to bring your own gorgonzola and bread. This Week in Water is sponsored by the American Water Works Association. Looking for solutions to utility challenges? Get answers at AWWA's Water Infrastructure Conference and Expo, October 30th through November 2nd. Learn more at awwa.org/H2O Infocon.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.